When the shift boss hits that button, then you'd better look alive, 'cause the lumber comes a-rolling like the bees out of a hive. And you'll feel that sweat come pouring as each muscle screams with pain, and you'll wonder if it's worth it working on the long green chain.
Kali Lassen is a different kind of environmentalist. His passion is trying to preserve our mental environment. Kali is founder and editor-in-chief of Adbusters, a magazine and a movement that started because Kali created a television ad saying BC's forests were in trouble, an ad no one would let him run, an ad that sparked a legal battle with the CBC that he finally appears to have won. I talked to Kali at Adbusters headquarters in Vancouver, BC.
You just won the court victory.
I know, yeah. That was an incredible moment. I must admit, after 20 years of being knocked back again and again and again until I was punch drunk, you know, and suddenly, wow, the court gives us a victory.
Now, why did it take so long? How did it take so long? Can you explain?
Well, I don't really know why. It could have just been the judge who read a recent issue of Adbusters, for all I know, right? But I think it's got, in my own feeling, I have a feeling that it's got something to do with the changing zeitgeist that 20 years ago, when we first launched this case, then, yeah, it was a bit of a joke. People didn't give a damn. I mean, who cares? Can you buy or can you not buy on television? But the world has become a much more dangerous place recently. Over the last 20 years, all of a sudden, we're faced with catastrophic climate change, and there's a possibility that things may tip over in a way that is very, very damaging for future generations, maybe for hundreds, even thousands of years to come. There's that ominous thing hanging over us. Psychologically, we're caught in something that most people don't know about, is that we're caught in an epidemic of mental illness where depressions and anxiety attacks are going up exponentially. And of course, politically, we all know that we're in this never-ending war against terror. And so ecologically, psychologically and politically, we're sort of hitting the wall. And all of a sudden, people are wondering whether they're really getting the information they need to deal with the future. And all of a sudden, the idea that, that the forest industry can go on TV and buy $6 million worth of airtime telling us that we have forests forever, and another side, a citizen of Canada cannot go on that same TV station and buy 30 seconds of airtime to tell the other side of the story, all of a sudden, that imbalance of who has the power to disseminate information, all of a sudden it becomes important. And I think the judge may have got wind of this zeitgeist shift.
What did you have to do to keep the case alive?
Raise a lot of money. we must have paid about $200,000 over the last 20 years to lawyers and various other costs to keep this case going. So it's been financially, it's been a nightmare. And that's why one of the reasons why we almost gave up a while ago. But I'm sure glad we didn't. And now now all of a sudden we're on a bit of a roll here, where we have more and more people are suddenly interested in this idea of information rights. And does a Canadian citizen, or for that matter, a world citizen, have the right to walk into their local TV station and plonk some money on the table and say, "Give me 30 seconds of airtime. I've got something to say." I mean, it's an important question to ask, you know.
Now, is the Canadian court case going to set precedent in any other courts? Is it?
That's our long-term plan, and always has been. We figured that Canada was the perfect place to start this worldwide movement for rights of access to television, and we thought that the CBC was always a very juicy target because it. You know, it's partly taxpayer funded and it's partly funded by advertising, and CBC has never quite gotten its act together, especially recently, and we felt that we had a good chance to win a legal action against them. And then once we win this legal action in Canada, then I think that media activists in other countries, in the US next, and then Australia, and then UK, and all these other places where we've tried to buy airtime and have failed, they will all realize that this is really a big time issue. It goes to the very heart of our democratic system. And if we, the people, don't have a voice, if we don't have access to our own public airwaves, then all these crazy people with their crazy ideas will walk all over us, and we won't be able to, you know, deal with all these big issues of the future. So we, I hope that this Canadian victory that we had a few weeks ago is the beginning of something that will eventually turn worldwide.
See, I remember when we first met 100 years ago to talk about this, you were talking about also starting a case and taking it all the way to the U.S. Supreme Court.
Yes.
Are you still up for that?
Well, yes, we actually have. We've been talking to lawyers in the United States for years, actually, and we've had various attempts. At one stage, we were actually that close, you know, an inch away from launching a legal action in the U.S. as well. But, you know, the U.S. law is different, and it requires a whole different approach, and they have other precedent-setting legal actions that have happened there in the past that are quite even more ominous than what we have here in Canada. But I think spurred on by this current, this recent victory in Canada, I think that I've already got a lot of U.S. lawyers. I don't know, maybe they're just out of work at the moment. But, after this case broke, I had about a dozen U.S. lawyers suddenly contact me and wanted to know more about this case and whether we can launch it in the U.S. as well.
Who would you go at there, CNN?
Well, actually, CNN, believe it or not, is one of the few stations who were about 5 or 6 years ago. They changed their mind and did start selling us some airtime.
They did let you buy nothing data,
yes,
didn't they?
Yes, that's the only network broadcaster in the whole world that's actually sold us airtime over the years. But all the other stations, ABC, NBC, CBS, the Food Network, MTV, Fox, they've all told us to go to hell and they're not going to sell us a second of airtime.
Okay. Now, what made me want to talk to you for the podcast series was I really wanted to talk about how this all started for you and how this case started. Because I know how this case started. I really want you to tell the story.
Well, I've told it so many times, I wonder if I can still say it spontaneously. But, you know, Adbusters Media Foundation was born out of a fight that we had with the forest industry here in British Columbia. Back in 1989... I don't know how many people listening actually remember this, but they had this multi-million-dollar campaign with ads on TV and bus shelters and the newspapers, full-page ads in newspapers, and they were getting a little worried about what's happening in the forest, and they were trying to make the British Columbians feel good about what they were doing. So they had this campaign telling us that they were doing a wonderful job in our forests and that we have nothing to worry about. We have forests forever. Was their campaign slogan. And a few of us environmentalists and filmmakers, we came up with the other side of the story. We came up with a 30-second spot of our own that tried to tell the other side. And then something happened which was for me a sort of a defining moment in my life and gave birth also to Adbusters Media Foundation. The same stations that were selling millions of dollars of airtime to the forest industry, when we came at them with our 30-second mind bomb, they refused to sell us any airtime. And that was a moment when I realized that there really is no democracy on the commercial airwaves, and that the big-time sponsors, you know, they will have their say, and the dissident voices will be kept out. And this was the moment that gave birth to everything that we've done since.
Now, what was it that outraged you so much about the Forest Forever campaign?
What is ask again?
What was it that outraged you so much about the Forest Forever campaign?
Well, it was just a fucking lie. It was they were telling us that we have forests forever, and the old growth forests at that time, as far as I remember, were already down to 17% of what it used to be, and the annual allowable cut was above sustainable levels. They were doing a horrible job managing our forests, and this $6 million campaign was just a PR smokescreen for them to continue their carnage. So the people who were really in the know about what was really happening in our forests, I mean, they were totally on our side. And when we started talking back against the forest industry and had this fight with the CBC and the other private broadcasters, then we had a hell of a lot of support from all kinds of forestry people and environmentalists who wanted this carnage to stop.
What was the official explanation you were given at the time for not being allowed to run your campaign?
The private broadcasters, they basically just said, this is not an ad, this is, you're not selling anything, we're not going to sell you any airtime. The CBC was a little more nuanced. They pointed to some Article 3 or something of their advertising policy, which said that advocacy advertising is not allowed on the air. Because, and their rationale was that if advocacy advertising was allowed on the air, then the people with the bucks, the people with the moneyed interests would be able to control the public agenda.
Okay, so the forest industry, which apparently has no money, was allowed to purchase ads.
And this was obviously an advocacy ad, right?
But that's the nuance I'm not getting, is how did they gesture with a straight face that the forestry ad was not an advocacy ad, but your ad was?
Well, it was really interesting what actually happened there. Initially, they just told us to go away, we're not going to sell you any airtime, and then we started going on radio shows and writing letters to the editor and creating a bit of a ruckus. We came up with a newsletter, which eventually turned into Adbusters magazine, and they were suddenly confronted with exactly the question that you asked, like how come that the forest industry is allowed to buy time, but this group of people can't? And eventually what they actually did was they pulled the forest industry ads.
Nice.
They pulled the forest industry ads and said, all right, you're also advocacy, we're not going to sell you any airtime either. And that was the beginning of it all, yeah.
Okay. Mm-hmm. I suspect that over the last 20 years, CBC has occasionally run something else that you would consider an advocacy ad.
Yes, they actually, the CBC, for all the sort of bad feeling I have about them because our fight has been with them, I mean, they've actually been quite responsible. They did then change their advocacy advertising policy. They realized that the times have changed and that some advocacy ads should be allowed. And on their main station, they actually said that on certain programs, under certain conditions, advocacy advertising will be allowed. The reason we're still going after the CBC is because on CBC News World, they had a blanket refusal to sell any airtime to any advocacy ads. So on CBC News World, they kept on selling ads to car ads and automobile ads and cosmetics ads and anything goes there in terms of selling products, which obviously also have their own advocacy component. I mean, every ad has its advocacy component. You know, when you're selling a car, then you're not just selling, you know, a Ford model. You're actually selling the idea that riding around in it with a ton of metal around you and with a radio playing is great fun and it's cool and this is really the only way to get around. So every ad, whether it's automobiles or cosmetics or fashion or whatever, it always has its own advocacy component. But anyway, on CBC News World, they drew this strange line where everybody else was allowed on, but advocacy ads were totally cut out. And now I think I have a feeling that the CBC may be softening a little bit and they may actually change the policy even on CBC News World. I sure hope so.
Now, what was your environmental involvement before doing the film, before going against the Forest Forever campaign?
Well, back in the 1970s and 1980s, bit by bit, I really got scared about what's happening to the planet. I suddenly realized that this human experiment of ours on planet Earth, that we were going through some sort of an existential moment where our own impact on the planet was starting to be catastrophic, and unless we found ways of dealing with that we would we would really hit the wall in ways unimaginable. So throughout the 70s and 80s I slowly became a more sort of greener and greener kind of guy.
Yeah.
And so that moment in time when we went against the forest industry and couldn't air our environmental ad on commercial television, to me that was sort of the moment when I sort of tipped over the balance and became a rabid greenie,
okay.
And started fighting the fight.
Now, had you done, as a filmmaker, I'm trying to remember, have you done any green films?
Yes, well, I made a film for the National Film of Canada about the global economy.
Okay.
And I was in that film. That was one of the first documentary films that ever talked to people like Hazel Henderson and some of the other ecological economists that existed in the world and presented this alternative view of how our economic system should be run.
Well, when you started Adbusters, in the early going especially, it was very environmental.
Yes.
Could you talk about the shift there and where your passion shifted? Where the magazine shifted, where your passion shifted?
Yeah, my passion didn't really shift. What really happened was that when we launched the first few issues of Adbusters back in 1989, then we were one of the few publications, one of the few voices that was actually boldly and radically talking about environmental issues. But then, even a couple of years later, by the early 1990s, after that first Rio conference and so on, then all of a sudden, some surveys were showing that 70-80% of all the people now see themselves as environmentalists. And I suddenly started picking up the Vancouver Sun on the weekend and seeing articles by people there that were actually better written than the sort of writers that we were able to recruit for Adbusters. And so bit by bit, the green voice, the environmental voice, rose up. And we at Adbusters became, we were still very passionate about environmental causes, but then we sort of morphed into mental environmentalists, because we suddenly wanted to launch a mental environmental movement, which we saw was sort of the other side of the coin from the physical environmental movement. And that was a new field. That was something that nobody was talking about, and that felt like we had a kind of a unique role to play and a unique voice to offer there.
Is that why you think you caught on worldwide?
Yeah, I think that we caught on worldwide because we were one of the first voices to boldly speak back against consumerism. This was back in 1989 and the early 1990s. I mean, anybody who started talking about the fact that we have to live more frugally and that we have to cut back on our consumption and that consumption has a dark side to it that we haven't woken up to yet, I mean, we were dismissed as kooks. So when we started talking that way, and when we launched Buy Nothing Day, and when it became a worldwide campaign in the mid-1990s, when we put it on the internet, that's one of the reasons that I think we became a worldwide movement. But the other reason is that we, right from the start in our brainstorming sessions, we said that we're tired of all the old movements, we're tired of feminism, we're tired of even of environmentalism, we're tired of the old political discourse, lefty discourse, and that we see that we felt in our brainstorming sessions that we, the people, were sort of losing our ability to generate our own cool, that we were losing the power to generate our own culture from the bottom up, and more our culture was being spoon-fed to us top-down by advertising agencies and corporations who wanted to sell us cars and whatnot. And companies like Nike who were creating a kind of a top-down corporate cool that somehow teenagers were buying into. So we said, okay, this has to stop. You know, once we, the people, lose the power to generate our own cool, our own culture from the bottom up, then we've lost everything. Then somebody else is basically doing the culture generation, doing the talking and giving us what's cool. Yeah. Once we lose the power to create our own cool, then something is severely amiss. And we launched this thing that we call the culture jamming movement. And our aim was to basically get consumer culture to bite the dust, and then to build up a new culture on the, you know, on the ashes of this consumer culture. And we call this culture jamming. And this movement, even today, is one of the hubs of global activism.
Well, how well did Buy Nothing Day catch on worldwide? Because I know everybody talks about it now.
Well, I think to some degree it's been around now almost for 20 years. I mean, I think this year, this November, it's I think it's our 17th or 18th year. It's almost as old as Earth Day. And it's to some degree, I think that it has done its job. When we first launched it was a joke. When people heard those three words, Buy Nothing Day, they just burst out laughing, because it was like an oxymoronic thing to think about. Now, voluntary simplicity is a big movement. Everybody's talking about reducing their carbon footprints. Everybody's talking about living more frugally and saving more. The current recession has made that kind of a frugality movement even more important. Catastrophic climate change is forcing us to consume less, whether we like it or not. So in a way, Buy Nothing Day has done its job. We were one of the first people to say things like that, and now perhaps more strident voices will take over from us.
What scares you most now, looking out at the world? What do you want to fix?
What scares me most of all is this feeling I have that the human race is going crazy, that we're in this epidemic of mental illness, where depressions and anxiety attacks and mood disorders are going up exponentially, and the World Health Organization is warning us that mental disease will be bigger than heart disease in another 10 years. And we are losing the clarity of mind to deal with terror, to deal with this last mad scramble for what's left of the world's resources. We're losing our clarity of mind to deal with climate change. We seem to be living in denial about our own footprints. The last survey that I saw in the United States showed that climate change is sort of number 20 in a list of political concerns that people have. So as I get to
go, under all the core stuff like which sports teams in which stadium and things like that, right?
Yeah, and when I tune into to CNN or whatever, I mean, there's still a few wonderful places, of course, on TV, and the internet is full of fascinating websites that do tackle these things. But by and large, the people in the rich 1 billion people on the planet, we are living in denial now. We're living in some kind of a bubble. We don't want to think about the fact that our footprints are five planet footprints, and we should really do something about it. And we don't like to think of that. And the people who live in India and China, who are still living brutal lives of not having enough. They, of course, aren't going to see the situation quite the way we do. So we, the rich 1 billion people on the planet, who consume 3/4 of all the goodies in the global marketplace, we are the ones who have to wake up, and I don't see that happening. And that scares me. I feel that we're in this sort of a nihilistic moment. And in fact, the next issue of Advice is about nihilism and revolution. And I think that we're living through this sort of nihilistic moment, a moment of denial, when we don't want to confront the fact that this human experiment of ours on planet Earth is now hitting the wall.
Now, what's the goal of Adbusters then? Because there are times it feels like the goal of Adbusters has always been to go beyond informing and to create activists.
Yeah.
Can you talk a little bit about that? About when you put an issue of Adbusters out in the world, what are you hoping is going to happen?
Yeah, well, I mean, what I hope is going to happen is that people have epiphanies when they read certain parts of it, and of course we have this special kind of a way of designing an issue of Adbusters where it's if you really delve into it, then it's like a comic book flow from cover to cover with sort of epiphanies along the way. And once you have an epiphany about you know, the future of the planet, or about your own role in this world, and what it really means to be authentic, or what it really means to live without dead time in this world, to really be alive and not to be forced to say, wait a minute, when it's time for you to die, to give people these kind of epiphanies and to turn them into rabid activists who fight back against this kind of a death scenario that I think we're in.
Well, I mean, it's fascinating because I was speaking at a Canadian university press conference. I mean, Adbusters is like the one thing I just sort of assumed that every young journalist has seen, and that every hip high school kid has an Adbusters snuck in their locker somewhere to figure out how to, you know, every kid is trying to figure out what to wear besides Nikes. Seems to be looking at Adbusters. So it fascinates me how it's caught on like that and how it's sort of become part of the culture.
Yeah, we've been around a long time, and we do sort of print 100,000 copies with every issue, and it's sent all over the place.
But it's like you've been around a long time, you've got younger. I mean, it's almost like...
Well, you know, everybody in this office except me is in their 20s or 30s.
Yeah.
I think that that young people especially, like the older people, for some reason, maybe it's the inertia, maybe it's having watched too much television in their lifetime or whatever. There's something jaded about a lot of old people. They're fighting the old fights and still stuck to the old media and whatever. But I think young people, in their guts, they really do see what I mentioned earlier. They see that we're being hit by a triple whammy. We're being hit by an ecological, a psychological, and a political whack. And this humanity is basically hitting the wall on three fronts, and they're scared. I think that young people, even if they're sort of most of the time running around and having fun and so on, I think that deep down in their guts they can feel that there's a huge possibility that by the time they reach middle age, this planet is going to be a hellhole, and that they're going to have to deal with it.
Are you still paying attention to sort of mainstream environmental issues in a big way, personally?
No, I must admit, for about 10 years of Adbusters, whenever we found another one of those stories about dead holes in the oceans or pine beetles eating up millions of acres of forests or whatever, then we would run these stories in Adbusters, and we were absolutely convinced that these stories are so horrible that they would wake people up and turn them all into environmentalists, and we would fix the problem. And, you know, it just didn't happen. It just didn't happen. So now we don't run those kind of stories anymore because it just feels like it just washes over people like water off a duck's back. So now I'm looking for new approaches. I'm looking for new aesthetics. I'm looking for deeper ways to get people to understand what's happening. And I'm trying to get away from that whole news cycle. You know, this whole, you know, like, oh, here's, you know, the, whatever, the polar ice is melting, and here's another story about it with a fantastic photograph of another chunk of ice falling off the, you know, off the shelf or something. So I think that one of the biggest problems facing people like me who really want to live a life, you know, doing something about this crisis that we're in, is to find new ways of communicating, new ways of new formats for magazines, new kinds of websites that are more maybe like video games and come up with new aesthetics, not this kind of a slick corporate aesthetic that we think is so cool and has ruled us for the last 20, 30, 40 years. Like the previous issue before this nihilism and revolution issue was about a new aesthetic. And on the one level you can say, well, what the hell has that got to do with anything? You know, who cares about a new aesthetic? You know, what are you talking about? Going to some art gallery and you know, falling in love with some painting on the wall or what? But I think that coming up with a new aesthetic for a down-to-earth organic aesthetic that emanates a kind of a urgency, this may be the big issue of our time. And also, this going back to our court case, winning this legal right for any Canadian citizen to walk into TV station and put some money on the table and buy some airtime and start speaking back against the car industry, start speaking back against the fashion industry and the fast food industry that's made us all obese. I can imagine the television mindscape being a free marketplace of ideas where you know, that is really actually fascinating to watch, because it's a meme war. It's a battle of the memes that are put out by the automobile industry versus the memes that environmental groups go out and may the best memes win, may the best ideas win. So I think one of the big breakthroughs that we have to make if we're going to stop this slide of humanity into some sort of chaotic hubris is to come up with powerful new ways of communicating and talking to each other.
What would you like to see the average Canadian go out and do? What would you like to see people change in their lives? And
well, I would really like for a few hundred or maybe a few thousand of us to get together and to start putting pressure on the CBC to stop running ads and to become a little bit more like the BBC or the NHK in Japan or like Sarkozy's TV stations in France are going right now. To become a real voice of the people, a place where we can talk about all these issues that we've been talking about in this podcast. I mean, why do we have to talk about this thing only on a podcast? Why can't issues like this be talked about every day, almost every hour on TV? And why can't we, when the program breaks to a TV commercial, why can't we have dissenting voices popping up during those commercials? What a wonderful message to send young people about our democracy, if we can do that. And right from the start, when they're still young, for them to wake up not just thinking that cars are cool and Big Macs are the most delicious thing in the world, but to also understand that 53% of the calories in a Big Mac are fat, and that cars and climate change are linked together, and perhaps we need a new form of transportation. So I think that, I mean, my dream would be for a small number, maybe it's only as small as 50, or maybe it's 500, or maybe if we're lucky it's 5,000, for 5,000 powerful Canadian strategists to get together and to start changing, first of all, Canada, change our broadcasting system, change our environmental policies, change our footprints, and then allow this kernel of activism that we pioneered in Canada to start spreading throughout the world. And for the CBC to become a voice in the world, just like the BBC is, for the Canadian people to have a geopolitical international voice out of the CBC, not some petty anti little thing that is constantly sort of pulling its punches.
Now, there are a couple of questions I've asked everybody for this podcast.
Mm-hmm.
If somebody came up to you tomorrow and put you in charge of BCs for us, what would you want to do?
Oh, I don't know. My first job would put my. I'd probably kick out all the old guys first. That would be my first. I'd just get rid of them and start changing the culture that we've had, the forestry culture that we've had here. It would be a long, I don't think it's some quick fix. I don't think there is any long quick fix, but I think we have to change the culture. We have to change the way we think about our forests. We have to change our strategies. And I would pull off a kind of an Obama-like slow shift of changing the culture.
Okay.
I would get the best people in British Columbia together, maybe 10 of them or 20 of them, whatever, and I would say, all right, let's design a new forestry culture. What is it?
And how do you feel about trees?
How do I feel about trees? I have about 150 of them in my place in Aldergrove, and I prune them and I eat their fruit, and I have one tree there that I've designated to be my mother, who died recently, and I talk to that tree every now and again. I have a whole grove of walnut trees, I don't know, I guess it sounds kind of petty, but I must admit I do love trees.
Thank you so much.
Thanks for tuning in to the Green Chain Podcast. Coming up on future podcasts, activist Betty Krozek, tree planter and poet Charlotte Gill, and controversial former Greenpeace boss Patrick Moore. For the Tyee, I'm Mark Laren-Young.